wasn't something that was given to us by much more reasoning than that. We basically were the equivalent, we, not me, of unpaid mall cops to keep guard of a frequency spectrum so it could be utilized at a later date. That's the downside of the whole thing. The upside of the whole thing, it sounds like they're looking for input, and we, including me, should find ways to forward that input to where it needs to go. So those are two sides of the conversation, and it's a great conversation to be had. Thanks for letting me input. Back to you, Roy.
You're welcome, Jim. I think historically, because of maritime situations, the Navy was in charge of frequency of radio waves. And sort of as you said, the very low frequencies were able to be used. You know, this goes back to very earliest times of amplification. So 160 meters and 80 meters and 40 meters was garbage, was useless. The Navy couldn't do squat with it. So there were inventors and guys who tinkered with the new radio technology, and they used spark gap generators, which caused all kinds of noise all over the place. And ultimately, the Navy gave them a license to use the upper useless frequencies. And fortunately, the demand for frequencies have never really been intense in the HF bands or even the UHF, VHF bands. Microwave is worth a lot of money. So I expect our microwave frequencies to be the first things to go. And yes, you can reply to this docket and make your own suggestions. Again, I'm concerned with the underlying motivational force. Your ideas will probably not address the docket's reason for calling for this, to optimize business opportunities. That's the worrisome thing. It's not to make life better. It's not some kind of altruistic concept or efficiency concept. It seems to be primarily capitalism in action. You know, how can we deregulate our regulations so that you can make more money? And there's no space for amateur radio in that question, at least none that I know of. Perhaps you have an idea, or other people smarter than me have an idea.
I think that makes some assumptions that have to be recognized as assumptions. Maybe they're true, maybe they're not true. We'll see.
Comment. Okay. Yes, please, comment.
This is 32 UAHM. Just to follow up to what FRU George said, I agree with him. If you look at one thing, who's going to be the target audience? The thing is, you know, for them to make money, I would assume it's going to be tied into advertising. And the thing is, who are they going to advertise to? Look at what happened recently. There was a big backlash because they were going to take the AM band out of the new cars. They weren't going to make new cars with AM radio anymore. And listen, look at how many people listen to news radio and AM. I don't think that people are going to be going out in droves and buying, you know, VHF, UHF, so they can listen to 14685 for the latest commercial. The younger generation isn't even using terrestrial radio. Everything is streamed over computers. So I don't see who the target audience would even exist to be able to receive to make money for anybody. Back to the next one.
Okay. I think, unfortunately, you know, we're kind of basing it on our history, you know, on our lifetime of how would you use a radio. Well, obviously, you'd use a radio. If you're not going to use it for amateur radio purposes, you're going to use it for broadcast radio purposes. I don't think that's where this is headed, because broadcast radio's life is on a respirator as well. Gone are the independent stations, gone are the independent radio shows. They're mostly syndicated pablum, and they're not going to last that long. So I don't think it's advertising expecting people to use it as a broadcast. There are other ways that you could use radio frequencies. We mentioned earlier that arbitrage allows you to cut the latency delays of the fiber optic transatlantic cables. So you could buy a frequency on the amateur band, a couple on different bands, because some days propagation is good for one and bad for the other. And so you could have a company that makes millions and millions of dollars on arbitrage by harnessing amateur radio frequencies as a dodge against the transatlantic cables. And I'm sure there's loads of other technology that we're totally unaware of, and pseudo-technologies that are theoretical that people can start up a company and try and make into a business. So I don't think it would go into any kind of advertising or broadcast, although Wesley quoted some guy saying that, you know, while you're working 10 meters, you have to wait a couple of minutes because the guy who owns the 10-meter frequency you're using is running an ad. I don't think that's a viable way, but who knows? Maybe it'll be one of many that some lunkhead comes up with and sends a letter to the FCC. I mean, that's what kind of concerns me.
With a comment.
Okay, we got some doubling. Hank, YDY, and Frank. YDY first, and then Frank.
Thank you, and good evening to all. My question is, since amateur radio proposes to use, or since they seem to be proposing to use frequencies that are also used around the world by other amateurs in other countries, how viable or how valuable would these frequencies be if they're still being interfered with by people in other countries?
Well, again, it sort of depends upon how the use is. If the use is for something like arbitrage, you may be able to kind of get enough of a range of frequencies to lock out your competitors that still wouldn't be subject to that much QRM from international transmitters.
Okay, and finally, I guess my next and last question would be, is there a place that any of us can go to read up on this, not just, you know, where the proposal is, but some place where we can find enough information to form valuable opinions?
Not really. I mean, the only thing that I have seen available to the public has been the docket and the comment to the docket and some, you know, comments of individual people that, you know, not with any kind of credentials. As far as I'm aware, the FCC hasn't been interviewed on the subject, and there's nothing in writing. So, you know, as time goes on, I would hope that the ARRL will publish some kind of a comment, an outline, and offer some information, because they have contacts in Washington. But at this point, I don't think there's much to go on other than hearsay and these two publications from the FCC.
Okay, thanks very much. Good night to all.
WS.
Yeah, Paul?
I just read something where they shut down Voice of America. So, you know, whatever they do, they're going to have to do quick. I mean, if that's already shut down, they stopped transmitting stories and changed over to music in different locations. So I'll have to verify, you know, I'm sure I'll see more about it maybe tomorrow. But I did see a quick piece of information. They had that Carrie Lake from Arizona. She took over, and the first thing they wanted to do is shut down Voice of America. Back to you.
Comment on that.
One second. I don't want to forget Frank. I just want to mention that there's a lot of deconstructing going on. There's a lot of disassembling, including things like the Social Security Department. There are powers that be that are looking to close buildings. There are powers that be that wanted to close the help desk telephone that services millions of elderly people's problems with their Social Security. And a lot of people yelled and screamed, and someone said, okay, we won't do that today. Maybe we'll do it tomorrow. Who knows? So there's a lot of deconstructing going on. There's a lot of disassembling and a lot of scary things going on. Nevertheless, Frank, I don't want to forget you again. So everyone, keep your finger off the trigger and let Frank say something.
Yeah, very good, WB2BX. So first of all, I wouldn't worry much about Carrie Lake's job. I'm sure they're going to lay off everybody else and let her keep her job, even though she has nobody to supervise, et cetera. And I will leave that comment. You know, and I'll leave it there on that. Be interesting to see what happens there. Now, in terms of the arbitrage proposal, as I understand it, I think it was on Amateur Radio Newsline a number of maybe a couple of months ago. What they were proposing to do was use high power several kilowatts and maybe even megawatts of point-to-point digital communications between their sites to try to beat the fiber optic connections by a couple of milliseconds, I presume. And I know the ARRL was aware of that proposal, supposedly, and it provided some comments on it. Not that they necessarily matter when there's a lot of money to be made. Now, the other thing is, I recall hearing on one of the, I think on Amateur Radio Newsline, that the military did use some, I forget what the technology is, automatic frequency selection. It's a technology that was, I don't have the acronym right, a technology developed during the 1980s that the military uses to automatically select frequencies that work between two points and go on them. And during the Afghan withdrawal, they did use that and plopped in the middle of the 20-meter band, apparently, to make some connections and pass traffic. That may be sort of popular. It's possible, I guess, that DOD would intervene and say, hey, we need the amateurs to protect those frequencies. You can't touch them. I think most of the frequencies the commercial people want to buy, though, are the microwave and the UHF frequencies that are valuable for their satellite links. And that's, unfortunately, that's a use it or lose it situation where a small minority of amateurs use those frequencies. And those that do, obviously, the short-range frequencies, and you don't hear them all over the place. So that's going to be a problem. My guess is probably not HF to a large extent. By the way, separate issue, Leroy, CBS Sunday morning had some guys on from a startup talking about fusion power and how they were going to start building a pilot scale fusion power plant by next year. And thought within 10 years they would have a full-scale fusion power plant going in Virginia. If you didn't see that, you can probably find that online and look it up. I'm sure that will give you a good laugh, since you know, fusion is one of these technologies that always seems that's always 10 years away or 25 years away or something. Enough said. I've probably gotten enough people mad. WB2BX. So.
W2BX.
Hey, Rich.
Yeah, as I think it was Frank just said, HF is communications on HF. It is too iffy to have any commercial applications, I think. Unless, of course, it's FT8 and technology like that. That seems to be, I mean, you can hardly hear FT8 signals. They're so low. So maybe something like that could be used commercially, but not regular sideband or AM or FM on HF.
Yeah, Frank, go ahead. Through 100%. We're just waiting for Roy to come back.
Yeah, I'm here. Something wonky happened with Glen Oaks. Well, I think I'm here, but I don't see anything. Do you hear me?
Somebody disconnected.
Okay, let's try this again. There seems to be a problem with the link, I think.
Yes, you are being heard, Roy. And I think my entire transmission, for whatever it was worth, looks like it went through WB2BXO.
This is AC2GS. Something very weird is happening tonight. I'm getting into the Echo Link. I might be going into Plainview. I definitely don't seem to be going into Glen Oaks.
There is a discussion on Echo Link because radio doesn't take it down.
Okay,
you
could work. Yeah, I was listening to you. It was very strange. I was listening to you on All Star, and I was looking at the feed coming back from Glen Oaks, which is silent. So I was trying to figure out how the hell I could get you at All Star, but not at Glen Oaks. And again, because Glen Oaks is another radio repeater, and the link apparently temporarily was out. It seems to be back now. Seems to have reestablished itself. So hopefully it'll behave for the rest of the night. I hope we didn't overheat it with our conversation.
Did you hear anything that I said?
Not this time. I was just talking. I didn't hear anything from anyone.
I was just saying that HF communication is too iffy to have any commercial applications, the way I look at it, except for technology like FT8, which needs very little to communicate on HF. But sideband AM, FM, I don't think would have any commercial application on HF.
Again, I think you're thinking in terms of, you know, mid-20th century. I'm not talking about them taking our frequencies to replicate what we do. If anything, whatever they try to do is going to be somewhat technologically innovative. They could make up their own version of FT8 that produces slow signal rate communications for, again, arbitrage or things that we have no idea that are being worked on. You know, there are a lot of clever and non-clever people trying to solve problems that we have and solve problems that we don't have. And I don't put it past these guys to come up with all kinds of esoteric uses that are not guys just stealing our frequencies and talking to each other. I don't think that's a thing. I think there are some sophisticated modes of transmission that could be utilized on the HF frequencies that might be able to be monetized. And I think that's where we got a problem.
Information point.
Yes, Jim.
An example would be what the military calls ALE, I think it's Automated Link Establishment, where they'll basically frequency hop over the HF bands to find where their signal's getting through and then work through that. Not something we do here, but something that they do here. And second point is that we're thinking through the lens of, part 97 stuff, ham stuff, or commercial stuff, or military stuff. There's also part 95 stuff that has failed most of the times they've tried, but there's that, those possibilities. And I want to thank Wesley for bringing up the best conversation he's ever brought up. Back to you, Roy.
What's part 95?
WB2BXO.
Frank recognized Jim. Rich has asked you what part 95 is.
95 being what we would call, I suppose, lower tier, CB radio, GMRS, FRS. I think there's been some other attempts at it over the years. Basically, lower tier civilian radio communications, which is, interestingly enough, if you read what the FCC rules, which that's an interesting thing in itself, is that it seems like the era of federal agencies making up rules with the effect of law is over. They actually have to make a law to make it a law. That's, I think, a good thing. Doesn't mean there's going to be some mayhem in the meantime. But Part 95 communication is generally meant to have people be able to communicate to do things rather than just make contacts and mention, you know, talk about their carbuncles. It's a thing. What that means to us, I don't know. But interesting stuff in play. Very interesting, I think.
I was coming to Poland.
EUFIU.
Guys, I appreciate your great behavior and your great interest in this. John N2ZC has been trying to get through EchoLink for the last 15 minutes and failing, and Frank is having problems as well. We're all fast keying. Please let us rest our trigger finger and let John N2ZC give him a chance to see if he can get through EchoLink. I don't know, John, you're coming up extremely distorted on my end. If anyone hears John, let me know, because it just sounds like a couple of little clicks and squeals. I don't know, John, maybe try to turn off your EchoLink application, turn it back on, and try again. Because when you try to transmit, it's a very strange. It's like it takes about 10 seconds of your voice, squeezes it together in a half a second. So it sounds like a little mouse making a squeaking noise. So try to kind of reset your EchoLink, and we'll try Frank, and then we'll get back to you. Okay, John? So, Frank, let's all pause and give Frank a chance.
EchoLink finally dropped and let me on. Before I go on and pontificate, am I being heard?
Yes, I hear you, Frank.
Okay, yeah, because I made a couple of relevant comments before, and then people went on as if they weren't hearing me. But it may just be my impression. Anyway, yeah, the ALE, that was a term I was looking for, Automatic Link Establishment, or ALE, which, as I understand it, is a military comms technology that's been around since the 1980s, that was used in the Afghanistan crisis a couple of years ago. I understand there was some ALE noted in the 20-meter ham band where the presumably the Air Force just plopped down there to pass traffic. And that may be something that helps us if the Defense Department wants to say, wait a minute, we need those frequencies for ALE, and the amateurs need to be there to protect those frequencies when we're not using them. The other comment, just to recap, was that the arbitrage proposal, if I remember correctly from a report on the Newsline, was to use very high power transmitters with monster antennas to pass traffic using very high speed data. So not really FT8, something much faster, with a lot of error correction, but I guess using enough power and big enough antennas on the point-to-point circuits, you can probably get good enough signals to do it even in poor propagation. And yeah, I did hear, I was wondering about that. Yeah, I did hear about the VOA, I think that was on the news today, about the agency that houses VOA being shut down. Of course, I'm sure that her nibs, Carrie Lake, will get to keep her job, even if she has no agency to run, for whatever it's worth. The WB2BXO, good, right.
Okay, very good. Yeah, we heard that your previous transmission. I know there's a little weirdness going on with EchoLink in general, but we heard it the first time, we heard it the second time. I don't think we can depend upon the Army to save us, unfortunately, but anything's possible. John, if you're out there and you want to try it again, hopefully this time we'll be able to hear your signal. So everyone rest their trigger finger for a second or two.
Yeah, Roy, November 2, Zulu Charlie, you copy?
Yes, much, much, much better now.
Okay, well, thank you, Roy. Thank you for the intermission. Good evening. Good evening to the men. All of this is very interesting, this conversation, and all very new to me. I just have one question. In this docket, I've been listening, so I've been hearing everything you guys said. Does it mention ham radio? Amateur radio specifically, and if it does, does it exclusively mention amateur radio, or is it talking about many other services? Again, this is the first time I've heard of it.
No, it does not mention amateur radio in any shape or form. It doesn't mention any service. It's a global call for comments from the public regarding deregulating and deleting as many FCC regulations as they can in order to optimize business interests.
Okay. I'm not going to panic at this point, then. There's a lot of things going on, and, until I hear anything specific, and that's just me, I'm not even going to, pay it any thought. But it may be the first shot over the bow, but, nothing to indicate that yet. Thanks again, Roy. November 2 is over with Charlie on the side.
You're welcome, John. Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. Really, none of us know for sure. Unfortunately, my crystal ball cracked. And I can't foretell the future on this one. So we'll hope for the best and settle for the rest. We are living in interesting times, which is a Chinese curse. Definitely, we are living in interesting times. I'm sure there's other people who want to make a comment. I've lost track of who goes next. I think it was George. George, did you want to say something?
I heard it coming.
T2GS, KD2, FYU, AC2GS. You got a copy?
Yeah, I hear you, George. Wesley, we'll take you after George, okay?
So I understand part 95. Is any device, anything, it could be an old motor on an engine of a car, it doesn't matter, but if it interferes with the communications systems that people are allowed to have, whether it's us as a radio operator or anything. Part 95 says you are not allowed to interfere or have a device that interferes with any type of telecommunications receiving system, period. Roy, I know that one.
Okay, very good. I mean, it's all in the hamper. It's all part of the rules and regulations that Chairman Carr is kind of offering on the table to cut and slice and change it as they wish. So I don't know.
Right, it's a cheap worldwide charger that sits on your wall from halfway around the world. It's not legal. That's part of Part 95. KD2FIU, thank you, Roy.
AC2GS, you're welcome. I think someone else wants to talk.
WB2HWW with a comment, guys.
Yes, Howard.
Okay, coming in from All Star. Everybody's making a big thing out of this. What I think is happening is they're looking at changing how the agency runs. What they're looking at is saying, okay, do we need all these regulations? Just for example, they're talking about do we need to regulate bandwidth, things like that. Leave it up. Say, okay, you've got this frequency, you can do what you want. As far as other things that are going on with the FCC regulates so many things like, low power transmissions. They may increase the CB power, say, okay, we're not going to regulate CB, and we're going to let you run whatever. That's what they're looking at, is to see how they can actually reduce regulations and not have the FCC into your life. The FCC has a zillion regulations, and half of them don't mean anything. Maybe they will make it easier for people to get broadcast licenses and say you don't have to do all the documentation. Just like at one time you had to have a first-class commercial to work on a radio station. Now you don't need a commercial ticket to work on broadcast equipment. Back to you.
Okay, Howard. I'll just read to you this notice from the office of the chairman of the FCC. It says, this is one paragraph among about four or five. Under President Trump's leadership, the administration is unleashing a new wave of economic opportunities by ending the regulatory onslaught from Washington, Chairman Carr stated. For too long, administrative agencies have added new regulatory requirements in excess of their authority or kept lawful regulations in place long after their shelf life had expired. So what I glean from this is a monetary motivation. It's not to make life easy for you and me, but I could be reading into it.
What they're talking about, okay, I'll give you an example. And I've read that same thing. What they're trying to say, if we're going to reduce regulations so people could make money through services, I'm not talking about amateur radio right now. Give me an example. Do you know how much it takes to put a broadcast station on the air? Are you aware of the fact that you can, you know, let's say you're a church or something, you want to broadcast a one or two to the cars in the, you know, in the parking lot. You can't do that because you have to run such low power. There are places in the country where there are free frequency spaces. If you want to put up an FM broadcast station, do you realize how much you have to go through in regulatory? That's what they're looking to do. They're looking to cut the fat. As far as amateur radio is concerned, yeah, we can lose some of these frequencies. But I think what they're going to do is say, okay, I think the worst they'll do to amateur radio is say, hey, you don't need a license. That's what the government's going to do. The government wants to get out of the business of working. Wants to cut the amount of people that they have on the payroll, so they're going to do away with a lot of the regulations. I don't think amateur radio is going away right now. You know, I think amateur radio is going to come like CB, probably no license, with very little regulations. That's all. Hey, they're not even regulating CB today.
Okay, that would be nice, but I think you're reading into it, which is fine. All we have is being able to read into it. I'm a little skeptical. You're a little optimistic in some ways and not in other ways, because I think that'll change the very nature of our hobby and turn it into CB, God forbid. But again, I don't know, but it worries me. It's too open-ended. It's too vague. And the things that aren't vague scare me a bit. So, again, you might be 100% right. Only time will tell.
Well, as far as, I don't want this to come to CB, but, hey, picked up, you know what, the bands are not being used that much. Yeah, you may have 750,000 or a million hams that are on paper, but maybe half of them are operating. Do it across the 440 band. Or do it across 2 meters. It's not being used that much. And you come on in the middle of the day and Live Market's dead. It used to be that the repeater would be used nonstop. There's less and less activity. So they're trying to get more and more people to use, you know, trying to get more activity. You know, you go back to the 1960s when they did away with the licenses and went to incentive licensing. A lot of hams got upset. The ARRL was behind that to sell more radios. And today, you know, they may say, well, why do we need all these regulations? Let's cut half the regulations. Let's just have no licenses or just give out call letters. I'm not in favor of that. At the end of the day, that's one way to make more money, make it easier for people to come on to ham radio so the manufacturer can sell more radios. All right, that's all I got to say. WDKHWW.
Okay. I don't think the federal government cares if Japanese manufacturers and Chinese manufacturers of radio have bang-up years. But, again, I your future is slightly better than my perceived future. And again, this is all just guys talking to each other because we don't have a clue what the powers that be have in mind. How long it's going to take for them to slice the pie up, who gets the pie, and whether they leave us with the droppings and such. So we'll see. I've utterly, totally lost track of who's next. So anyone want to comment? Jim. Okay. Well, Wesley's been trying to get back on for a while now. So first Wesley, then Jim. Okay?
Yeah, I had a discussion today, actually. I had a discussion today with two young gentlemen. One is graduates at MIT, and the other one is fifth generation or rabbinical student. I remember my old rabbi that I love so much, Rabbi Fahy from Ahia Zatura Center. But anyhow, the conclusion was actually around that what Paul said. Radio Free Europe was closed, not totally yet, but say it was closed. Voice of America was closed. The institutions that are 90 years old, 70 years old are being closed. And those are government sponsored or sponsored by the Congress or whatsoever. And that's what they told. And they told, you know what? Imagine that you have a situation where there is no middle class, it's rich, and those are who are not so fortunate in life. That's what you're facing. It's the first time my dad and my grandpa, rabbi, they told me that it is a unique time that never happened in the lifetime of their family because they spoke to their fathers, grandfathers, grandfathers, whatsoever. It never happened. It's for the first time that we have a situation where money is in the first place. And that who makes money for whoever else is at the last in the row. So the question is, how those two nice and educated gentlemen are wrong or right? So we try to have intelligent conversation because it's 2017, so it's a time for a space report. Intelligent conversation is far from politics. We try to have a strong value. So I believe Dr. Roy would be the best one who would put some light on it. Back to you.
See, that's what I was worried would happen. So we got this guy. Anyway, well, we're gonna kind of shut it down soon because it's coming up time for the SpaceNet report. We have lived in the age of the robber barons. John, KC2WGB, rest in peace. I always think of good old John. John loved the robber barons. He thought that the robber barons made the United States what it is today. They made it on the blood of Chinese laborers on the railroad in all kinds of terrible ways, and you know the Panama Canal, all the people down in Central America who died of malaria and cholera and all kinds of things. So we seem to find ourselves now in what we call the age of the oligarchs, but it's still the robber barons. You know, hopefully we will find our own Teddy Roosevelt, who got rid of the robber barons then, and we'll get rid of them now. You know, people kind of say, eat the rich. They're probably very indigestible. So I don't know what to tell you guys. For the most part, I was very proud of you all night long. Only one jerk made funny noises at the very end, but we were able to have a rational, intellectual discussion on the subject. We have very little to go on, unfortunately, but I think we did our best, and I want to thank you and tell you how much I appreciate tonight's opportunity to discuss an important thing. With that in mind, Wesley, I think maybe we should table the rest of your topics for tonight, because it's already 10:20, and move on to the SpaceNet report. You okay with that?
Absolutely, Dr. Ray. Absolutely, I'm okay. I do thank you very much for making the summary. I believe it was the excellent summary. Using excellent wording, I would be able to do that. But it is actually benefiting all of us, because we are aware of what's happening, what might happen, and for the first time, uncertainty is something that dominates. And to you, and thank you very much.
HD, we're closing comment.
Okay, Jim.
Thank you. I know that was rude, but I wanted to say that it's interesting how many ears are listening. And when the conversation gets interesting by whoever brings it up, how much input's there? There are people listening. And I thank you, Roy. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jim. And again, I thank everyone who participated tonight. You came through. I had my concerns and my worries that this might kind of fall into the abyss, but we kept it working, and I enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed it. We may enter back into the subject in later weeks, months, if we get any kind of useful new information that gives us a better idea of what's going to happen to us. So I thank you all. Paul, let's go to the SpaceNet report with Paul WS2N.
Thanks, Roy. ACQGSWS2N for the SpaceNet. And, okay. Go to Glen Oaks on high power. Let me see how long this is going to last. I wasn't getting the Selman repeated too good before, so for some reason. So I decided to stay with this. Anyway, there was a crew 10, they call it, that launched to the International Space Station. Anybody watches the news, I'm sure they saw that. Actually, they tried to get off the ground on the 12th, but the rocket, the Falcon 9, had it's attached to these gigantic clamps, and there's hydraulics hooked up to the clamps, and these clamps hold down clamps, and they're not released until they get up to full thrust. And they realized they had a problem with that, and found out later that there was air stuck in a line, and they had to eventually bleed that off somehow. But to do that, they couldn't do that in real time. They had to wait a couple of days. So the crew finally got off the ground a couple of days later, and the crew was, you had Ann McLean, the commander, then Nicole Baz, I think it was. She's a first-time flyer. Well, the commander has been up there before. And then you had one fellow from Japan, Onishia. They always bring somebody up from a foreign country, usually involved with European Space Agency. But Japan goes up quite a bit. And then they had one fellow from Russia, cosmonaut, and they still do that. Anytime a Falcon 9 goes up with a crew, they always have to bring up at least one Russian, and anytime a Soyuz spacecraft goes to the space station, they have to bring at least one American up as well. So that's the deal between the two countries. And, they docked with the International Space Station a little over 24 hours It's around 31 hours or so after launch. They did that yesterday, and then it takes a couple of hours before they can actually open the hatchway to let the crew in. And with that, those four joined the other seven on board, including
astronaut Sonny Williams, you know, who's a ham, KD5PLB, along with Butch Wilmore. He's not a ham, but they're the two that supposedly were stuck in space all this time. They also joined two other Russians. Actually, there was three other Russians on board. They joined them, and that is a total of 11 people on board. And if you want to see these people, Roy put up a nice picture. I sent him a picture that Nasser sent down of the whole crew of all 11 on the International Space Station. And you can see that there's plenty of room for these people, and they're all very happy. Nobody's stuck. And, you know, I get a kick out of the media for months. They're all stuck. You know, meanwhile, when they go up there, they usually stay for 6 months anyway. Some fellows have stayed for a year. I think Christina Cook, she stayed for a year. You had Frank Rubin, he went up, he thought he was going to stay for 5 to 6 months. He wound up staying for over a year, so it's not unusual. But for some reason, they made this very unusual. The deal was they were supposed to go up for a week to 10 days, maybe 2 weeks, and the spacecraft they went up on, built by Boeing, called the Starliner, had some issues, and they could have come back in that. In fact, that would have been an emergency vehicle for them to come back the whole time when that was attached. But they decided, well, better be safe than sorry. We'll bring the spacecraft back by itself, which it did. It came back and successfully landed where it's supposed to, in White Sands, New Mexico, on solid ground. It's designed for that purpose. And they stayed for a whole period of 9 months. But another crew came up. They were supposed to come up with a crew of four. They canceled two of them, so they only came up with a crew of two. That was after a couple of months that they were up there. Those two will bring back Sonny and Butch. Within a couple of days, I heard Wednesday they're coming back. So they'll come back and land in the Atlantic Ocean near Florida. And if the waves are, you know, where they can't land there, they always have a plan B. And plan B is in the Gulf of Mexico, right next to, right near Florida, usually around the throat of the Gulf. So that's the plan. I'm sure there'll be plenty of interviews with Sonny and Butch. And there's been plenty of interviews when they've been up there. And they said, no problem, we're doing science up here. Two of the spacewalks they both did. Sonny Williams has had half a dozen spacewalks. She's been up there couple times before. So during this flight, she did two spacewalks. So did Butch. And 900 science experiments are always going on at one time. So they were a big part of the science experiments, which would have been done by the other two anyway, the two that got left behind. So now that spacecraft that came up with the two, that's the spacecraft they're going back in. So I get a kick out of the news media when they say, here's the spacecraft going up on the other day. And that's the rescue vehicle. They're going to be coming back. They're bringing them back on that. Well, that's not true. That spacecraft will be attached to the International Space Station probably for the next 6 months. And if it went up with it, will be the crew that will come back in it. That's the story on that. Any comments on Crew 10 that went up to the space station? WS-1.
You know, Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. Paul, this is Charlie. Good evening.
Hi, Charlie. I was waiting for you to key up. How you doing? Any comments?
Yes. Now there's just 11 people on the space station. And Butch and Sonny come back on Wednesday. There's going to be 9 people. It's getting a little crowded, don't you think?
Yeah, it is. No, they'll go back to 7. Right now there's 7 up there. We just put 4 up, 9. Now it's 11 people. When Butch and Sonny come back, they're not coming back just by themselves. They're coming back with the other 2 that had gone up 5 months ago. They came up by themselves, so they had the 2 extra seats. That was the plan. So now those 2 and Sonny and Butch will come back, and that will leave 4. Now you got me doing it. That will leave 7 on board the space station, Charlie. And you know, you think, well, it's crowded. At one point, when the shuttle was going up and down, temporarily for a short period of time, they actually had 13 on board the space station. Back to you, Charlie.
Okay, so 4 people are going to come back on Tuesday.
Yeah, originally I heard Tuesday, but I heard now it's Wednesday. So I'll look for them to, come back through the atmosphere on Wednesday. So that's the story with that. Okay, another picture that Roy put on his website for me, and by the way, he puts it on roy.ac2gs.com. You just put that in, and you scroll down, and you see all the posts that he puts up. He's got some good topics, a bunch of medical topics as well. But, you know, just scroll down a little further, and you'll see the 2 pictures, the crew that's up there, the 11 that's up there right now. And then another picture you're going to see, it looks like an old eclipse. Well, it is an eclipse, but it's an eclipse of the Earth. Now, you might remember the other day, on the 14th, well, late on the 14th into the early hours of the 15th, we had a lunar eclipse, you know, where the Earth blocks out and the moon turns like a reddish color and eventually, you know, almost completely disappears. Unfortunately, from New York, well, a good part of the country, it was cloudy. I did look up around 1 o'clock. The clouds had a little reddish glow to it, but you couldn't see the moon, and so due to the forecast, you know, as far as I was concerned, it was bedtime. The picture that's on Roy's website, what that is a picture from the moon. We have an American company called Firefly. They launched a couple months ago, and they landed a spacecraft up on the northeastern part of the moon, and it's called Blue Ghost. Well, Blue Ghost is sitting there. Got there in the early, what you would call the early morning of the moon. The moon has a morning, afternoon, and late afternoon and night. And that whole daytime period lasts just 14 days. And then the other 14 days are dark. But during those 14 days, we have this spacecraft sitting there called Blue Ghost. And it's sending back good telemetry on X-band antenna. One of the first lands has the X-band antenna. But then they deploy the X-band as time goes on. And they get all kinds of information back. And they get good, great video. They're actually sending high-depth video back to Earth. So, that thing is doing good. And they knew if they made that window that they were going to land during this time frame. They knew that the eclipse would be you know, on the 14th, and they know exactly when it's going to be. So they planned on it. They figured, well, let's take a picture and see what it looks like, and then we'll send it back to Earth from the lander. And that's what they did. So that's what you're looking at. You're looking at the Earth, and you're looking at a ring around the Earth. The sun is behind it. So it's kind of like instead of a lunar eclipse, it's I guess an Earth eclipse. It's unique. You know, we've never seen that, you know, from that point of view before. You know, there are spacecraft out there called Discover that's out, you know, a million miles out where the moon goes in front of the Earth, and but it, you know, the size changes when you get a million miles out, so it doesn't look like this. So it's a great shot, and I think it's pretty unique. And you know, if you put it into the internet, and you put eclipse from the moon, you know, from Blue Ghost, you know, you can see probably a million different websites with the same picture on it. It's pretty good. Name of the company is Firefly. It's Firefly Rocket Company. Now this one was launched. They paid SpaceX to launch it. And Firefly is actually working on their own vehicle. They've launched half a dozen times so far, but they weren't ready for this one. Next time around, they will probably launch, I think, two missions from now. They plan on launching another one of these types of landers in the near future. But then I think the time after that, they plan on launching on one of their own rockets. They'll be completely independent. You know, rocket launch company plus, a lunar lander, which is it's pretty good. A lot of companies trying to do that now. And we'll look forward to more of it. There is one that's built by Japan, a commercial one that should be landing, I think, in about a month and a half. It's out there now, but it's got a different kind of way of getting to the moon. But we'll wait to see how that one does. The one after this that tried to land, that one didn't work out. That was by Intuitive Machines. Yeah, I talked about that one last week, and I was the one that landed and sure enough tipped over, and they've stopped trying to communicate with that. The solar panels aren't charging. But this is a good lander. Look forward to future landers. It's kind of short and kind of wide, and I think that's good. You know, you have a wider footprint when you land. I think less of a chance of tipping over. Now, by the way, the night, you know, it gets like nighttime when these things, you know, when you have a lunar eclipse like this on the moon. So it went from, I think, 230 degrees of Fahrenheit, and it dropped all the way down to minus 400 and, I wrote it down somewhere. Anyway, you're way down there. Minus 419 degrees Fahrenheit. They're able to do it because of the short period of time, and this lunar lander, yeah, it's being charged from the sun, but it charges, I think it's got a 20 amp hour battery. It charges that lithium ion battery, and no problem, working for a short period of time in darkness. In fact, at the end of the 14-day mission, when it goes into lunar nighttime, they predict that the vehicle will still be transmitting data back, and good science data, because they need to know a lot of things that go on when the temperatures drop. So it will last for about 5 more hours after dark. So that's a story on Blue Ghost. Any comments? WS2.
phone.
Okay, nothing heard.
Blue ghost.
I wanted to bring this up last week.
Drilling.
Talk about it at X-37B.
Okay.
Has returned.
How far can they go down?
That is a spacecraft actually built by Boeing, and it looks like a very small shuttle. And what it does is that it launched different rockets over the years, and gets put into orbit and stays up there for a long time, and completes a mission. This one happened to be 430 some odd days, and then they eventually bring it back. Now it's for the defense. It's not a NASA program, so there's no NASA money going into the X-37B. So it's launched by originally the first couple of launches. By the way, they have two of these things, these shuttle-like looking vehicles. And the first couple of them were launched by a Atlas V, from Florida, and they come down and land, and the first couple of them landed in California and Edwards Air Force Base, and then eventually they fly back to Florida for another launch. Some of them, a couple of them have lasted, like one was 290 days or something. Another one's 500 days, and then two of them ago it was 900 days. So that was the longest flight, and this one is over 400. But it goes into orbit, and it does probably a lot of, top secret stuff for the government. We never really find out. There's been a couple of NASA experiments that they have put on board these things, testing out different materials and things like that. So the X-37B, when it launches, they put it on top of the rocket, put the fairings around it, and it's got these wings that, short, stubby wings. And when it comes back, it comes through the atmosphere, no problem. Everyone has been a success, and they land on a runway. Sometimes they bring it back to Florida, and they land on that 3-mile runway that the shuttle used to use, and all autonomous. It's got a heat shield on it, tiles. Looks like they never fall off. It's really a great vehicle. It has these doors that open up, kind of like the cargo bay doors on the shuttle that one used to do. And they have different experiments. It's got solar panels that come out of it. So it's a good vehicle. Everybody's waiting for Dream Chaser eventually to get going, and that should get going probably by the end of the year, unless it's delayed, maybe springtime of next year. But that's supposed to go sometime this year to the International Space Station. And that, again, looks like a small shuttle, but it's not built by Boeing. That's built by the Sierra Nevada Space Corporation, headquartered in Colorado. And that will eventually bring cargo, a tremendous amount of cargo, up to any space station, either ISS or future space stations that go up. So that will launch similar to the X-37B. They'll put it into the fairing of a top of a rocket. By the way, this one has been launched on a Falcon Heavy. Three Falcon 9s bolted together. This one has successfully been launched by that thing twice. And same thing with the Sierra Nevada Dream Chaser. When that starts to go up, that will be launched the same way on different vehicles. They plan on either launching on Falcon or the
the new Vulcan rocket that's being built. Or, you know, they said we'll even launch on the Ariane 6 rocket from European, from the, you know, by the European Space Agency from South America, from French Guiana, if we want to. So it's a very versatile vehicle, and I'm sure it's got a lot of experience from the you know, that was gained from the Boeing X-37B. So we'll see. Somewhere down the line, Sierra Nevada has plans on this thing. Right now, it's strictly a cargo vehicle that could bring up to 12,000 pounds to the space station. Presently, they're designing one that will eventually be able to carry a crew. So that should be interesting on how they would do that. They'd have to put it on the top of a rocket without a fairing, because, you know, you have to have the ability to abort when going to orbit. So, you know, if you have the fairing up there, and you're sitting on the launch pad, and the rocket decides to blow up, you need to get away from it. You won't be able to do that with fairing. So what they have to do is design this where it could just sit on top of the rocket, no fairing. So that, you know, that eventually they will plan on doing that, and that will be a crew vehicle. Many years from now, but we'll be able to be around to see that. That would be great. Any comments? WS2M. Okay, we're talking about different rocket companies. There's another one called Relativity Space.
The Fireflies.
They have launched one rocket so far.
Now, this is
called the Saran. And it was actually the first liquid methane, first liquid oxygen vehicle to actually attain orbit. Everybody was wondering who was going to do that first. That was going to be Boeing with the Vulcan rocket, which is also liquid methane. Was it going to be the European Space Agency or SpaceX? SpaceX with their vehicle, their Starliner vehicle that they keep having problems with. You know, that's liquid methane. Turned out it was this company called Wrong company. Let's backtrack a little bit. There's Firefly, they're the ones that are launching vehicles, and then there's Relativity. Just don't want to confuse the two. Anyway, let me put it this way. Relativity has announced that they plan on launching the Terran R. It's a reusable vehicle similar to Terran 1, which they launched a couple of years ago. First one to orbit with liquid nothing. Anyway, that company is doing good. They plan, once they launch in space, probably early next year, they think they're going to be able to have 50 or 100 flights annually. So it won't only be SpaceX doing this. It'll be Relativity. It'll be Firefly. It'll be Stokes Space. Stokes plans on having complete reusability on the second stage and first stage. Right now you have Rocket Lab. They're launching on a regular basis from New Zealand, and they also have a launch complex in Virginia, which they've launched a couple times from. And they plan on going up to... I think this year they plan on doing 30 some odd launches, if not more. Let me see. I think I had that information about Rocket Lab, because they launched 2 days ago as well. They launched a SAR mission, a synthetic aperture radar mission for Japan. But they plan on doing many, many launches per year. Already they're up to their fifth one, I think, this year. And it's only, you know, we're only a couple of months in. So we'll see. A lot of competition out there. Turns out SpaceX is not going to be the only game in town. eventually New Glenn, they launched recently, and they put their heavy lift vehicle into orbit on the first shot. So that's another one to consider. And I'm not even mentioning some of the foreign countries, you know, places like India and China, and you know, we're looking at, you know, hundreds of launches per year to try to follow. And that's going to, of course, be impossible. Any comments? WS2N.
No comments, Paul. No comments.
Thanks, Charlie. Very good. And the voice, I just want to mention them real quick before we close. The two Voyager missions, of course, are doing great. Launching in the 70s, 1977. They were like a couple of weeks apart when they went up. And they're out there now 47 years. So just reading that, you know, I just want to do an update on that. We've talked about Voyagers many times on the net. And one of them, Voyager 2, is out 144 AU. It's like 13 billion miles, but AU is a better way to look at it. 1 AU is the distance from the sun to the Earth. And that's, you know, 93 million miles. But that distance, you take 144 of them, and that's where Voyager 2 is. Voyager 1 is even further. They're out at 168 now, 80 AU. Astronomical units at 15 billion miles. So they're doing great. They do have to keep shutting down different instruments. It started with 10 instruments on board, different things, you know, plasma detectors, cameras, all kinds of weird things, you know, magnetometers. And little by little over the decades, they shut things down because they tend to lose power. They do have RTGs on board, radioisotope thermoelectric generators, which are producing, each one produces 109 watts, and each one has three on board. But that wattage has dropped down significantly over the years. They say that it drops, they lose around 4 watts per year. So, you know, they have the power, they recharge it, you know, they're able to get enough power out of it to run some of these instruments. But I think they're down like 3 or 4 instruments. They just, the reason it was in the news is they just shut another instrument down. But they expect it to be transmitting for many years to come into the 2030s. So that's really something if they can do that. So of course we're following that. You know, by that time it'll be, you know, I don't know how many more AU out there. Probably another 34 AU. Maybe. Voyager 1 will probably make it to 200 AU. Any comments? WS2N.
No comments, Paul. Nope, not tonight.
Okay, very good. I don't have much more to add. We'll keep looking to see what we come up with new stuff for next week. You know, talk about, you know, possible future missions. I like to talk about the past missions. They're the easiest to talk about because they're done. Future ones, you know, we make these predictions, and we hope this is going to happen, and that's going to happen, and next thing I know, it's a couple of years later, and, you know, you wind up having delays and scrubs. And, you know, they stop funding missions, or they come up with a new mission that we never heard of. I know, I think the other day, SpaceX launched the Sphere X, they call it. It's a mission, but it's a telescope, and it's going to look at all I believe that's the one that's going to look at galaxies. And there's another one that went up with it. That one has four different suitcase size spacecraft on it, and that I think they call it Punch. Anyway, that one's they're working as right now as we speak. But I'll talk about that more next week. But anyway, they got two telescope type things up there, and the four that is like a suitcase are going to separate, you know, from each other slowly as they orbit the Earth. And as they get further and further apart, they're going to use interferometry, and they're going to be able to, whatever they're looking at is going to pretty much come out in 3D. So I'm looking forward to that. And we'll talk about those two telescopes next week. But I'm going to shut down, and we'll turn it over to Dr. Roy. And tomorrow night we should be on with the the info net, and that's followed by Swap and Shop with George. Let me drop it. That's followed by Radio Newsline. I'm sure that'll have information about the topic that Wes brought up earlier today. We'll look forward to that. And Roy, I don't know if you know, if you got a notice or anything, but you wound up with an award, a certificate, you know, from the club. So I just want to let you know about that. Roy, over to you, AC2GS, WS2N.
Oh, thanks for telling me, Paul. I have no idea that it happened. I have to look into that now. Anyway, thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do on the technical net and all that you do for the club. I appreciate it, and everyone else does as well. And I appreciate everyone who participated. I hope you enjoyed the St. Patrick's Day edition of the Limar Technical Net. I did. I hope you'll come back next Sunday when we try and do it all over again. As always, a few parting words. Dick, K2RIW, used to end most of his tech nets with the advice to be kind to each other. So I certainly think that that's a good thing, especially in these interesting times. So please, be kind to each other. And good old Epictetus, it is impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try to keep your mind open to new ideas, but don't open them wide enough that your brain might fall out. Anyway, have a great week. Stay safe, be well, and hopefully, if you can, come back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. And this is AC2GS formally closing this episode of the Limark Technical Net. And I will be clear after I say Slava Ukraine and Viva le Canada.
Okay, Roy. Yeah, and by the way, I wound up getting one as well for the SpaceNet report. So, you know, that was for the membership appreciation day that they had on Wednesday. Anyway, have a good night, Roy, and we'll be here next week. WS2N.
Viva who, Roy? WB2BXL.
Viva le Canada.
Good night to all of us, and one more do I.
Hey, Siri, what is my new notification?
Good night, guys.